My name is Gill, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
As you can see, I'm carrying two cups, which means that I'm no longer a sneaker, but I've remained a gulper. I was trying to think of something profound to say to Annette and Artie and Jerry and Stan. Instead of that, I just tell them what was on my mind when they were introducing themselves. When they were introducing themselves as newcomers, one of the things that ran through my mind was the hope and some kind of a prayer with the thought that they would be ready for whatever there is here. And also, I think I was thinking that now that their reputation has been blown all to hell by showing up once, they might as well keep coming back. I started drinking in my first childhood, which was long enough to allow a lot of things to get started. It lasted 45 years. I'm glad that I didn't have a traumatizing childhood. I didn't have an unhappy childhood, because I'd have a hell of a time rationalizing that now that I don't have to drink anymore, I also don't have to rationalize as much. And I'd have a hell of a time rationalizing why I made it last 45 years if it had been unhappy and lousy. It was a childhood that I, as I remember it, had more, where I experienced more contentment than discontent. And if that adds up to something like happiness, well, then I had a happy childhood. I said that often when my mother was still alive, that I had a happy childhood, because I thought she'd like to hear that. But I was not traumatized. Maybe the reason I think about that a little bit is that I work in sort of professionally in the field of alcoholism as a physician. And I hear, quite a few people comment on wondering whether or not there's a relationship with their alcoholic reaction to alcohol and the fact that they were traumatized or they experienced a lot of crises in their childhood. And that wasn't my case. I did not experience much trauma. I was not a victim of child abuse. I was not a victim of child neglect. If I was victimized by anything, as I remember, it was the delay in child molestation. I had to wait for that for some time. It finally came, but I was not traumatized by it. I took to it, really, kind of comfortably. And it didn't seem to matter much whether I was the molestee or the molestor. That doesn't make any difference. So I kind of became lustful. I guess I called it passionate for a long time. But it was probably, when I took my inventory, I discovered that it was lust instead of the passion that I thought that I had. Well, I had some passion too. I had my share of these things. Anyway, I discovered booze, and I don't know exactly how old I was. One thing I remember about the effect of booze on me, or the effect of my first encounter with alcohol and alcoholic beverages, was not so much the brand that I drank or the type of booze that I drank or who I drank it with or whether I drank it from coaxing or from challenging or any of those things. What I remember about my first encounter with booze is that I found it impressive. I was impressed by it. I thought that there was something there that I had probably been looking for and didn't know, I guess, how to order it. Well, I was too young to order it. Anyway, when I came across it, I was impressed by it. I have not ceased to be impressed by the effect of booze, by my relationship with booze. It's an important part of my life, really. Just like finding a way of being without booze one day at a time, not having to drink one day at a time, which sometimes reminds me that if I want to to maintain the assurance and the guarantee or something like that to myself that I will not have to drink today if I choose not to, I must also accept the responsibility for every damn drink I ever had. I choose not to call it a blame, or I don't feel guilty about the drinks that I had. I just feel that I was responsible for every drink I ever had. And this helps me recognize that if I was responsible for every drink I ever had, Then if I choose to, I can feel kind of certain that with the help of you and higher power and this program, I will not have to drink today if I choose not to. Because as soon as I refuse to take the responsibility for any of my past drinks, that means that whatever made me take it, if it wasn't through my own choice, if that was to repeat itself today, I would not be able to say that I have a choice about drinking or not drinking. Anyway, the effect of booze on me was impressive, and I was going to keep going back to it as often as possible, for as long as possible, and as intensely as possible each time. I had, I guess, what can probably be described as an average course of alcoholism. I had a fun phase that lasted a few years, which kind of played some funny things on my head, such as making me think that I was a non-alcoholic because it was fun, because I didn't encounter the troubles and the problems that I thought alcoholics were supposed to encounter in order to have an alcoholic reaction to booze. Well, the kind of fun that I was having and the difficulty I had remembering the kind of fun that I had while drinking was an indication to me that it was alcoholic type of reaction from the beginning, really. But I had a fun phase. I thought it was due to controlled drinking. But, you know, I tried controlled drinking when I realized that, when somebody told me that I was losing control or some damn thing. And I really didn't like it. I don't like controlled drinking at all. I have no quarrels with the RAND report that says that 10% of people recovering or having recovered can go back to normal to controlled drinking. The only thing about that is if I was making any kind of pseudoscientific survey of these people, I would not be all that curious to find out whether they can drink in a controlled fashion or not. I want to know if they're enjoying it. Because if it's lousy, I don't want to do any controlled drinking, frankly. I tried that, and sometimes I sort of, at least in the eyes of other people, I seem to have succeeded a few times, and I hated it. Jesus, I didn't like controlled drinking at all. I find nothing attractive about controlled drinking, really. So I had a fun phase in my alcoholism, and then the second phase, I guess, is sort of the run-of-the-mill, which is what I had. I'm an alcoholic of our type. That's my classification, by the way. It's in step, you know, and then chapter 3. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. Because in the field of alcoholism, also around AA functions, we hear about types, and we hear about, not as much as in the field, I know that, but we hear about, you know, street alcoholics, skid row alcoholics, ethnic alcoholism, and we hear about juvenile alcoholics, and we hear about senile alcoholics in retirement communities, and we hear about all those things. I'm kind of fascinated by one category that is supposed to have the largest number, and I'm also fascinated in wondering how in the hell we know that it has the largest number, and that's called the hidden alcoholics. As a matter of fact, I'd like to specialize in that now. I work for a hospital in bankruptcy, which belongs to the taxpayers, and that gives you a reflection of the economy in general. I work for the federal government, and I'm going to be axed, and I'm going to be riffed, is what it's called. I just discovered that. What was about to happen to me is called being riffed. And after I'm riffed, I think I would like to specialize, if somebody wants to back that up, that project, I'd like to specialize in the hidden alcoholics. Because I'm getting tired, and I'd like to sit back in the office and just read a bunch of stuff. Like read Hustler and Penthouse and things like that. And if somebody showed up sometimes and I would ask, well, what did you want to see me about? And the person would say, well, I want to see you about the problem that I have that I think has something to do with alcoholism or problem drinking. I said, I'm sorry, you blew your cover. I specialize in the hidden alcoholics. I'm going to have to refer you somewhere. That would kind of be appealing to me right now. Well, I went to school. And I stopped drinking a lot in my life, which also blows my cover. I didn't know that. I thought, you know, by insisting that I could go on the wagon, I thought that I was proving to the world, as if the world gave a damn, really. I thought that I was proving to the world that I was a non-alcoholic. So I've got to go on the wagon. Somebody finally told me. You know, have you met very many non-alcoholics who've gone on the wagon a lot in the last 2 years? And I've surveyed that. I've gone around and asked non-alcoholics, and they say, what do you mean on the wagon? Do you think I should? Or, you know, is something the matter here? They don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Boy, I used to know what I was talking about. I also knew what day I went on the wagon, what hour of the day I went on the wagon, and I knew what day I fell off and what hour I fell off. Non-alcoholics don't seem to know that. They just say, well, yeah, I was a while without drinking, but they don't pay that much attention. So I was preoccupied with alcohol, even when I was going through the fun phase. But probably because there is a fun phase, I doubt very much that there's ever going to be a prevention of alcoholism in the sense of, like vaccination or inoculation. I want to tell you that during my fun phase, or my first phase of alcoholism, of my alcoholism, you would have had one hell of a time to sell me any vaccine. I'll tell you. You know, this is also true of other illnesses. I think if there were fun phases for most illnesses, if there was a fun phase for poliomyelitis, the sock vaccine would have never gotten off the ground. Can you imagine if a family was in communication, say from San Jose or from Sunnyvale, talking to somebody in San Francisco on the phone, and people in San Francisco would say, well, the reason we haven't been getting in touch really is because we've had some sickness in our house, and there's a couple of the kids who have polio. And then the other people say, my God, that's terrible. No, it's all right. We have some friends who come from Hayward. They also have polio. And they rent an ambulance every once in a while, and they come over Friday afternoons, and they spend the weekend. Sometimes they don't go home till Wednesday. We have a ball. You couldn't have sold a vaccine to the rest of the family, really. And that's what was going on with me during the first phase of alcoholism. I was having a lot of fun. However, there were times when I didn't remember the fun. And that was tough because I also had tough hangovers. I had lousy hangovers. I really had... That's not what keeps me sober. At least I don't think so. What keeps me sober is this program, the practice of it to the best of my ability, and the fellowship of this fellowship. However, I had some lousy hangovers. I was trying to describe them one night at an AA function, I guess. I was trying to describe my hangovers, and I thought that I hadn't come close to really being very articulate enough to be very accurate in the description of my hangover, so I don't try to do that anymore. But on the way back home that one night, I remember hearing on my car radio, while I was listening to a Western country music station, the title of a Western music song that really describes my hangover. And the title of it is, I Feel So Bad, I'm Gonna Have to Get Better to Die. That's what I felt. And I thought, shit, that's it. I wish I'd thought of that. It was also a good number, and I wish I'd thought of it because it fits me to a T. Well, the hangovers then were kind of the coming off phase, which were really kind of lousy. And the same as that runs through these three phases, kind of run through my individual drinking episodes or experiences, the same three phases in the general course of my illness and my alcoholism also run through. I had a fun phase, and I had a fun and trouble phase. And then I had a complication phase or a crappy phase, you know. That's the third phase. And in the individual drinking episode, the same things kind of happened to me. I would have a fun phase, which I guess could be called the getting drunk phase, the GD phase. And that was terrific. I don't care what anybody says. I haven't stopped thinking that. And I haven't stopped feeling it. As a matter of fact, that's the part of my active alcoholism that I can re-feel if I sit there and want to think of it enough, vividly enough to recall it. I can re-feel that part. I can't re-feel the second part, that was being drunk, and that's a big question mark. I don't know what the hell that was. I have to drink again to re-feel that, and I choose not to do that. And I don't want to re-feel the crappy part, for God's sakes, you know. Who in the hell would? So it ran that way, pretty much, my experience with booze. The getting drunk phase, the being drunk phase, which was a question mark, and the coming off phase. Also, the general course of it ran, of my condition or my illness ran that way. Well, I had a lot of fun, and then I started having trouble. I started having trouble, and during that second phase of having both fun and trouble, I did something that may be typically alcoholic. I don't know what the hell is typically alcoholic. I only know my own experience when it comes to actually feeling. And What I did then during the fun and trouble phase was to keep giving credit to Bruce for all the fun and being very careful not to blame it for the trouble. Well, I was very cautious about that. Somebody said, maybe that's because you drink too much. Yeah. I like to agree with that I drank too much. I liked it then, to when the mounted police, I was born in Canada and grew up there and did part of my drinking there, and the mounted police told me that I drank too much. And then there was some kind of communication between them and the California Highway Patrol. They told me that too. And I don't know how they knew, come to think about it. You know. Well, I know how they knew. I was also, knowing is also something that I think about once in a while. I was not the last one to know that I was an alcoholic or that I was having some problem with booze. I was the last one to know that they knew, but I was not the last one to know. I knew when I was having, when I felt so bad that I would have to get better to die. I knew then there was something the matter. There's something wrong here. I'd stand in the bathroom and say, Jesus, man, wow, that's awful. I feel awful, and I look awful. I'd think, geez, I guess I'm going to die. You know, I could die this way. And then I'd look in the mirror and say, Christ, I can't die looking this way. You know, what are they going to say? You know, family members start filing through, and I thought there'd be a lot of people in the funeral home, and, you know, what kind of comment is that going to generate the way I look? I better have a couple of belts, and I'll die sometime this afternoon when I feel a little bit better. Well, what I did then, I guess, or one of the things I used to do then was try to say, I think somehow I said to myself, you know, thank God I had a blackout. That must be when I had all the fun that justifies this way of feeling, because I couldn't remember having enough fun to justify that. So I went through these things. Well, I also went through, I guess what I call a long childhood, long in the sense, in the figurative sense, as well as having it last until I got sober, until I came to this fellowship, it was long also because I was bored by it. I was bored by it. Maybe because it was a happy childhood, I was bored by it. I don't know, but not much seemed to happen. And after I started drinking, even less seemed to happen, at least less productive things seemed to happen. So I would quit drinking often. I went on the wagon a lot and stayed on the wagon for substantial periods of time, which is how I got through school. I was a pretty good scholar, a pretty good student. I don't know about being a scholar. I'm not scholarly. I'm kind of mediocre. I liked it when a psychiatrist told me I was an overachiever. I said, that's great. You know, I hope I cause this to materialize before I die, because shit, so far I haven't given a damn about achievement. I really am not all that enthused about achievement, frankly. I have a very simple life, but I used to find it dull. I used to find it dull and boring. And I thought things lasted a long time. Man, time weighed heavily on my hands, even though it seemed to me that I was spinning my wheel, when I think back on it now. Well, boy, somebody asked me one time in my first marriage how long I'd been married. I said, shit, I don't know. I was born married, I guess. It seemed to be indeterminate. I had indeterminate sentences all the time. Man. And, you know, going to medical school, going to college lasted a long time. Going to medical school. Actually, I graduated and I finished my internship when I got licensed to practice medicine anywhere in Canada when I was still 24 years old. So I hadn't really taken an awful lot of time to do that. What I did then was retire when I was... Yeah, after I got all certified and qualified and all these damn things that go with overachievers like me, you know, I retired for about a year and a half. All I did was bum. I think I had some kind of a goal that was called bumming. It's not usually referred to as a goal. You know, it is, socially speaking, bumming is not supposed to be a goal, but it was for me. And I enjoyed it. I wasn't all that good at it. I could only make it last a year and a half. I wasn't on welfare or SSI or ATD or anything like that. I could have been on ATD. I was totally disabled a good part of that time. But I wasn't on ATD. Actually, I was living with two nurses. And really, You know, it's a form of welfare that I would recommend, frankly. I didn't have to fill out any applications. There were no long forms to fill out. And didn't have to get a doctor's certificate or any of that stuff. Didn't have to have a physical. If I had a physical, I probably would have... To qualify for that, I probably would have been turned down. Well, anyway, after a year and a half of bumming and alcoholic drinking, I disqualified myself. You have to add certain qualifications to have this kind of support system. And after a year and a half of alcoholic drinking, I disqualified myself. I disqualified myself most of that time, really. But there was always the hope that I would re-qualify, I guess. But that didn't materialize. So I went to work. And went on the wagon, and I went to work. When I wanted to get anything done, like, you know, wanting to go to work, I would have to go on the wagon. Building a practice, I would have to go on the wagon. I moved around a fair amount. This wagon that I was traveling on got around a little bit. I'd fall off, which is how I traveled quite a bit. And if I'd have stayed on the wagon, maybe I would have stayed put. But then I probably would have become bored, would have lasted a long time. And so I moved around a little bit. I guess I wanted to have going away speeches made at me. And if you want to have going away speeches made at you and you're an alcoholic, don't fall off the wagon. Leave while you're still on the wagon. So I did that in a fair amount of places. Anyhow, I practiced both in some places, my alcoholism and my profession. Actually, I did that where I guess I must have thought it was a little bit safe to do it, which was in towns where I was the only doctor. And the roads were closed. People couldn't go to see the other doctor who lived 60 miles away. And he couldn't come to make house calls there either. And so it was kind of, I don't remember thinking about it that way, but I must have felt that it was a little bit safe, or had the illusion that it was safe, really. It wasn't safe. I hear a lot of questions about that when I disclose that part of my experience to the effect of, you know, what did the people do when they got sick? Well, they healed. That's what they did. That's what they did, you know. One small town where I stayed 11 years. Sometimes people ask me, you know, how did the people get better? And I say, well, they had a higher power. That's how they got better. They had a higher power, and I got out of his way when I got drunk enough, you know. So I suppose I got away with a few things. I've never gone back there to make amends. Matter of fact, I went back some trips and planned to make amends. And Jesus, I started walking the streets in a small town. I was there last December. I didn't walk the streets very much in December because it gets cold up there. And I run into people who tell me, you know, how great they felt since whatever they had while I was there, they recovered from and stuff like that. They give me credit for it. How can I stand there and say, by the way, you know, I want to tell you that, you know, I don't remember making that house call, and I don't remember you being in the hospital. They show me their kids, and they say, you know, I guess you don't remember him. You know, he's now 21 years old, but you delivered him. I said, shit, I got news for you. I could say, well, I didn't remember it the next morning, frankly. Because I had, well, that I can recall that distinctly, not remembering if somebody had delivered or not. Because on my way to the hospital, some mornings, I went through periods of anguish, and an anguish that could only be relieved by a couple of belts. You know, we don't call, you know, alcoholics don't call drinks drinks, or we don't much call them cocktails or highballs, you know. Just kind of belts or horns. Anyway, some mornings, before having a couple of belts or a couple of horns, I would be walking towards the hospital thinking, Jesus, I remember that I got a call about 6:30 last night, and I was maybe discussing scientific matters with the local druggist, which meant drinking VO with the druggist. His VO. I'm also a cheap drunk. I'm not very flush. I'm cheap and I'm chicken. And somebody asked me recently if I ever got drunk when I was angry. I said, yeah, a couple of times. And I got hurt because I forgot I was chicken. It's not healthy. If you're the kind of drunk that I am, it's not healthy to get drunk when you're angry, to start drinking when you're angry, because what happened to me is it made me forget I was chicken. Well, and we get hurt that way. Anyway, I remember walking towards the hospital some mornings thinking, Jesus, I know I got this call at 6:30, and maybe I remember the 9 o'clock, or I remember going and checking things out. That's what it was called. And I would say, well, I don't think you're in labor, really. I think it's false labor. I didn't wait long enough to really establish that. But I'd walk away, so I think you're in false labor, and if anything happens, well, the nurse will call me. It's better if you stay here. The nurse will call me if anything happens. Maybe I remembered the 9 o'clock call, but then that was it. I didn't remember the delivery. Well, I went into a lot of hot flashes. I had early menopause. Periodic menopause. It didn't stay with me. Every time I came off in the third phase, I would have menopausal symptoms, consisting mostly of hot flashes and cold sweats and nervousness and anxieties and unnamed fears, and I had these things. So I would be walking towards the hospital thinking, Jesus, I wish I'd remember if Mrs. So-and-so delivered or not. Well, there was an easy way to deal with that, but I didn't know about the easy or softer way. The easy way would have been to just go make rounds. And if she was in a bed with a flat belly, for Christ's sake, she was... then I'd know she'd delivered. But it kind of bugged me, and I thought, I got to find some way to, you know, to deal with this eventuality here, because it might happen again. And it did. It happened again and again and again. They only got pregnant a few times. I felt that way many times. So one day when it dawned on me that this was something that I should find ways of coping mechanisms, is what we call them in the field. I was looking for coping mechanisms. And my coping mechanism for that particular instance was to go around the little nursery that we have. Only 7 beds, and in effect 7 cribs in the nursery. And I would, in the newborn nursery, and I would then make it a point every day at noon when I left the hospital after the morning's work before going to the office part of my day, I would count the babies. I would count the babies in the cribs, and I would write that on a small, I don't know, book of matches or something. And I'd try to put that book of matches somewhere where I wouldn't be utilizing it the rest of the day, in case the next morning I would go through this anguishing period of not knowing. I would say, well, shit, all I got to do is go to the nursery first and look at the number that was there yesterday noon, and if there's one more, that'll mean that there's somebody delivered. And, you know, I didn't have to do that, frankly. All I had to do was make rounds. And I got, that was a very confusing coping mechanism. Are there any physicians in here? It's I don't recommend that. It's very confusing. It's kind of time-consuming. And also, people in the rest of the hospital, I was a generalist then. I was in general medicine, practicing general medicine. The rest of the hospital are going to keep thinking you want to be a pediatrician. And that's, the nurses kept asking me if I was going to take a postgraduate. And as a matter of fact, when I left there to go to a postgraduate, they said, you're going to finally take pediatrics. And they thought I loved these kids in the nursery. I didn't love kids in the nursery. They cried a lot when they were hungry. Well, they cried when they were thirsty, and so did I. I should have identified with them, really. I cried when I was thirsty, too. I didn't call it being thirsty. I call it, you know, being hungry. I'd say, well, Jesus, you know, I haven't had a thing to eat since yesterday, and man, I'm hungry. Let's go and have a couple. I didn't mean let's go to McDonald's, have 2 hamburgers. And then I'd be tired, too, at times. I'd say, God, I haven't had, you know, I was up most of the night, only had an hour and a half sleep. Let's go and have a couple. And I didn't mean 2 hours sleep. You know, a couple always meant the same thing. A couple of belts or a couple of horns. Anyway, I went through the so-called fun phase that way and then started having some troubles. And I quit. I quit and did a postgraduate. And at the end of my postgraduate, I was drinking during the postgraduate a fair amount because I had less responsibilities. I had, you know, fixed hours to put in during the day or during the week, and that left me some free time, and I only knew of one thing to do with my free time, and I got drunk quite a bit, and I puked quite a bit, and I sweated quite a bit. And then I decided to did my third year of postgraduate back in Canada and decided to come back to California to practice. Well, that became something important. I have to take the California State Boards. I'm going to have to build a new practice. I'm relocating, and I don't think that people around the Bay Area have been really waiting for me to come and practice obstetrics, and they're going to line up at my door or hurry up and get pregnant now that they know I'm coming to town, you know. I had stopped often for something that seemed to be important or that were brought up to me as being important. I remember having a junior partner joined me in 1951 or 50, in the early 50s. And he showed up on the... I thought we drank socially, both of us. Well, he was drinking non-alcoholically and I was drinking alcoholically. And somehow he noticed this. And I guess he noticed it. And I should have admired his diagnostic acumen because I didn't think anybody else noticed it. You know, I was the last one to know that they knew. And one morning he showed up at the office and said... they were newlyweds, you know, for a few months. He said, Margaret and I were talking at the breakfast table, and he said, it seems there's a pretty good chance she's pregnant, and I told her I would ask you how long before her due date you think you can stop drinking. I thought, oh, shit. They're beginning to know. I said, I'll stop right now. He said, don't be crazy. She only missed one period. I said, doesn't matter. I don't know if I said that to him, but in my head I remember thinking, that doesn't matter. I just committed myself to be sober when she delivers. And if I commit myself to be sober when she delivers, I gotta stop now. And I was kind of a... commitment was not something that I was very comfortable with, but when I made a commitment, I knew that I couldn't drink. I guess I knew, because I didn't. And I was pretty much that way, I think, a good part of my life. So it should not have been surprising when I came to this fellowship and started getting acquainted with this program and read about it and heard about it as being a spiritual program. But I was confused with that too. I confused that in religion. And I was listening to the definition again tonight. And I'm fascinated by this definition of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Neither endorses or opposes any causes. And, wishes to engage in no controversy. He does not wish to engage in any controversy. I was thinking, that's how Christianity started too, wishing to engage in no controversy. And I don't know what happened, really. I don't think it's fallen apart, but there were a few interruptions, like the Spanish Inquisition, the Crusades. Those were controversial things, you know. However, in this program, I haven't seen these controversial things developed, and I haven't seen these conflicts developed the same. There are conflicts because there are personalities. Anyhow, it should not have been surprising to me when I came to this program and heard about it being spiritual, that because I read recently, not in AA literature, I read somewhere, but it may have been in AA literature, I read somewhere that the definition of spirituality, of human spirituality, could consist of only two words, and it really wraps it up. And that is commitment and concern. And when we have commitment and concern, then we're being spiritual. And I've run across this in AA all the time. All the time. I have to come here to find that combination of commitment and concern. And also to find that I found it attractive. That I wanted to have some of this. I wanted to have what you had when I came here. And so anyway, because I, at least part of that was still with me during parts of my drinking years. Meaning that when I made a commitment, I knew I couldn't drink with it. So I must have known that drinking interfered with my sobriety. I mean, with my spirituality. Of course, it interfered with my sobriety. But it also interfered with my spirituality, because I couldn't be committed. I also couldn't be concerned. Not being concerned to me represents a syndrome that really goes well with alcoholism. And that's called the off-screw-it syndrome. When I'm reminded of my obligations, and I'm reminded of my responsibilities, and I'm drinking, I respond by saying, oh, screw it. And you know, I hear this in drinking situations quite a bit to this day. Not that I expose myself to them any longer than I need to. Not until I get too tired or I'm on the verge of getting too tired or too lonely. I don't stick around drinking situations very much because I think I know what I want to know about drinking. There's nothing about drinking that I want to know right now. There's a lot about sobriety that I want to know. There's a lot more that I want to know about sobriety. There's a lot that I don't know about drinking, but I'm really not that much interested in it. Anyway, commitment and concern are two human attributes and two human qualities, I guess, that can constitute spirituality. Well, when I had commitments in the past, I had to stop drinking in order to carry them out. And I made myself a commitment in 1956, and I quit drinking for almost 18 months, I think, almost a year and a half. I was telling an intern or a first-year resident at the hospital that part of my own experience some time ago, and the guy said, I said to him, after 17 months, I said, I picked up a drink and I couldn't stop for 2.5 years. And he said, what happened? I said, I just told you what happened. He said, no, but this, did somebody die in Canada? I said, I don't know. Shit, somebody must have died in Canada. But I don't remember being notified of anybody's death. I just picked up a drink and I didn't stop for 2.5 years. I just told you I was an alcoholic. You've been in this goddamn unit for a month. What are you learning? Then he told me what he was learning. He was learning from patients, and that's okay. That's what he should be learning from. But he said to me something like, did you have a craving? I said, I don't think so. He said, did you have a compulsion? I said, shit, no, I wasn't going to wait for that. I mean, I'm an alcoholic and I want a drink. You think I'm going to sit around and say, I sure hope I got a compulsion, man, I want a drink. A compulsion? I don't remember waiting for compulsions. I probably had compulsions once I started drinking. I had a compulsion for my next drink, I know that. Anyway, 1956, I was not unhappy being sober, you know, even though it was not the same as the, I guess what's referred to as AA sobriety, which I consider synonymous to spiritual sobriety because it includes commitment and concern. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, commitment and concern, so I found spirituality. However, even physical sobriety was not unpleasant to me, really. I wasn't trying to run away from that when I picked up a drink in the summer of 1957. I just thought I'd have a drink. This seemed to be a good idea. As good as any at that point, I guess. Well, during those 2.5 years, my character became disorganized. And people had a hard time, you know, I guess deciphering that. And rather than say, well, I wonder what's happening to Gil and his character, which is becoming disorganized, they said to me something like, you have a weak character. I thought, Jesus, if you had to look for booze the way I have to look for booze some mornings, you can't do that with a weak character. I never said that to anybody, but that's the thought that went through my... Or somebody even said, you've lost your characters. What do you mean, I lost it? Sure hope I find it again, because I'm going to need it tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. I had done some things that indicated some kind of strength of character. God, I practiced in coal mining country in the foot of the Canadian Rockies once upon a time for 3 years, and I walked 6 miles at 67 below for 2 bottles of beer. You can do that without character? You will freeze to death if you don't have any character. Man, you can't do that without character. So during those 2.5 years, my character continued to be disorganized, I guess, or became more disorganized, and it says it in chapter 3 also what happened to me then. And I lost all interest in commitment. And I certainly had no concern for anybody else's commitments, for that matter. And I lost my spirituality. And I lost my sensitivity to the human condition, which is the same thing, again, as spirituality, at least in my understanding. Those are only my thoughts and my understandings and some of my biases, I guess. But I'd lost my sensitivity to the human condition, because at the end of those 2.5 years, during which I was not drunk around the clock, but I drank every day, and I think every day I decided not to drink. At least the days that I didn't feel too bad, I would decide, well, Christ, I think I'm going to make it without it today because I feel fairly good. Went to bed at a decent time. I thought I'd congratulate myself with that or for that. And having congratulated myself all day, well, then towards the end of the afternoon, I would reward myself and have another drink. Never quite made it through. That's the way I remember it. I never made it through one day. What's more, even the days that I didn't drink much, it was the most important thing I did all day. Now, I didn't, intellectually give it the most importance of what I did during the day. If you'd asked me, you know, you did an operation this morning, and apparently it was quite a, you know, something or other, and it was pretty substantial, and you did a fairly good job, and your intern told us that, or the nurse told us that. Was that the most important thing you did all day? If you'd asked me that at 10 o'clock before going to bed, and if I'd been honest, I would have said, no, that's not the thing I thought about the most often during the day. The thing I thought about the most often during the day was the few drinks I was going to have before dinner and the ones I had after dinner. That was the most important thing in my estimation at that time, any day of those 2.5 years. Well, I ended up in a small apartment. I made a commitment, frankly. I accepted a condition for something. At a party that had been lasting for 3 days. And that was kind of my style. A 3-day party was not an expensive, sophisticated thing, you know. That wasn't my style at all, really. I was not into sophistication very much. I'm not strong. I don't do sophistication very well, really. There's other things I don't do well. I don't do humble very well. I know that, you know. But I was at this thing, this bash that had been going on for 3 days. And it was Sunday afternoon. And somebody came up to me and, well, a couple of nurses again, for God's sakes. Not with re-inviting me to do the same as I'd done. They weren't the same either. Anyway, these were two nurses who were on their way to the airport and they had stopped at this thing. They hadn't been participants for the 3 days. But they had stopped at this thing to talk to somebody whom they wanted to see, who happened to be there, and they were on their way out of the country for 3 weeks, and they were going to be away, so actually it's because they were going to be away that they invited me to stay at their place. I became guests of people who were going to be away. And I'd get invited under those conditions or those circumstances. So one of these gals, and I had lunch with her yesterday, and I had not seen her since then. And I was truthful. I told her how many times I had told this story and mentioned her, and I don't know how many times, so I couldn't tell her exactly. But anyway, she came up to me and said, you look tired. And I said, well, yeah, I look tired. As a matter of fact, I'm exhausted. She said, where are you staying? She didn't ask me where I lived because she knew that. She knew where my house was. I don't know what made her think. I never asked her. Should have asked her that yesterday. What made you think I was not, you know, to ask me where I was staying? I said, well, I'm staying here since Friday. And Thursday night, I guess I slept in my car. What the hell? And she said, well, I want to give you the key to our place. Rosemary and I are leaving for 3 weeks and want to ask you to stay there, which... geographically, it was only a couple of blocks down the street from where this was taking place. She handed me the key, and she said, well, you have to promise something. So I gave her back the key. Well, I call that my spiritual awakening. It was sort of a glimmer of honesty that was breaking through all this decrepitude that I was carrying around on my carcass, and above my shoulders, mostly above my shoulders where I had all this deterioration. And she said, you don't like making promises? I said, on the contrary. I have a lot of experience at making promises, and I love to make them. I'm not a promise keeper. I don't keep promises. That's my honesty. That's all I had. It's about all I had left. And I gave her back her key. She said, well, why don't you hear me out? She said, why don't you, let's call it a condition. I said, okay, what's the condition? She says, the condition is that if you're still drinking by Wednesday, you get the hell out of there. I don't know why. I asked her yesterday, she says, I remember saying that, I don't know why. So she had some kind of insurance policy that only covered her for 3 days of my activities. I don't know. I don't know that. She just felt that her things were kind of sturdy and durable and they could stand 3 days of my drinking. But by Wednesday, I should get the hell out if I was still drinking. So somebody offered me a drink just then. And I said, no thanks. And the person says, why not? I said, well, I just accepted a condition not to be drinking Wednesday. So I couldn't have lasted a whole pregnancy, I guess, like I did a few years before with my junior partner's wife. But I figured 3 days, maybe I can do that. And he said to me something like, shit, it's only Sunday. You're disoriented. Well, I'm that too, but that's not the point. The point is that I just made a commitment. I'd made a commitment not to be drinking Wednesday. So I moved into that place. Well, I went to that place. I didn't have any things to move. I believed in traveling light. Anyhow, I moved in there, and during those 3 days, I don't know if this was my worst hangover. Who in the hell can measure that? I don't think I can. Anyway, I remember pacing the floor. But I'd done that many times. I remember talking to myself. I'd done that many times. I remember, heaving a lot, and I'd done that many times. I remember perspiring a lot, and I'd done that many times. And I remember being confused, and I remember all kinds of things like that. Shaking. I don't know if I ever feared having convulsions, and I don't think I had any. Anyhow, I paced the floor and I kept saying, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? Most of the times I think I said it with anger. And most of the times I said that, and I kept repeating that, I think I said it with some kind of bitterness and probably what would constitute cursing. Somehow it turned into some kind of a prayer. It's not the kind of prayer that I want to teach my kids. You know, they'll learn that anyway. So I have four kids under 12 years of age, and I'm kind of grateful for that, really. I feel good about it. And sometimes people ask me during arm's length, hey, how the hell, you know, Christ, look at my hair. And say, what do you mean, four kids under? What hole is a baby? The baby's 5 years old. How the hell that happened? I don't know. I'm an obstetrician, I don't know. Well, I think it's due to high fidelity, not high frequency. Anyhow, I feel good about that. And people say it must make you feel young. I don't know if it makes me feel young. I don't know what it is to feel old. Interns ask me questions like that. How does it feel to feel old? Shit, I don't know. You know, don't you feel old? I hope you'll forgive me. They apologize. Well, don't apologize. You're just asking me how I feel. And if there's such a thing as feeling old, I don't know if there is such a thing as feeling old. I feel like a young guy has got something wrong with him. That's what I feel like. Maybe that's feeling old. I don't know. Anyhow, I was in that place, and I kept saying, Christ, I wish I knew what to do. And there were times when I said it with a little more decorum, I guess, a little more respect, or a little more desperation. I don't know, really. But I remember kneeling down and looking at the wall. There was a cross like that. And looking at the wall and saying to God, you know, there was a crucifix, a symbolic cross of Jesus, of the Lord. And I remember looking at that and saying, God, you know, I sure wish I'd... And I didn't know how to say that to him, you know. I'm 45 years old at this point. And I started saying that. I thought he should be reminded how old I was. And I said, you know, here I am, 45 years old, with a lot of university degrees. And I started naming my degrees. I named some I didn't have. You know, I think at times I may have been successful at conning myself mostly, and occasionally conning other people. I don't know what made me think I could con him or her or whatever it is, you know. But I went through that. And finally I finished that litany of degrees by saying, I haven't got a goddamn clue what life is all about. And I must have had in my mind, I wish you'd tell me. Give me a clue. Give me some kind of help. I got the clues. I got answered, which is why I call this a prayer instead of a curse, because I started getting answers right there. And the answer consisted in a variety of things. It wasn't a single thing. I started remembering two people that I had heard about who were my kind of drinkers. I didn't know they were my type of alcohol, or alcoholics of my type. But they had been my kind of drinkers, which means I'd never seen them sober. But somebody told me about them one time when I was inquiring about them, and it was my father. He said, geez, you wouldn't recognize them. I said, what's the matter with them? He said, you haven't heard? I said, no, what's the matter with them? He said, they haven't drank for over a year. I said, what's the matter with them? I was suspicious right then. You know, you can't, how can you have, Jesus, there was no penicillin in those days, but there was at least sulfur. How can they not drink for over a year? Must have had one hell of a severe case of, you know what, that used to keep us from drinking until we were recovered from that. Well, anyway, my dad says there's nothing the matter with them. And he started naming a list of fringe benefits, which he didn't call fringe benefits. I finally quit asking him stupidly what's the matter with them. And I said, how do they do this? And he said, I don't know. He wasn't being cagey or cute. He just didn't know. He said, all I know is that they go to meetings, and I don't know what they do there, and I don't know what the meetings are called, but they go to meetings, and they belong to an outfit called AA, he said, and I don't know what the letters stand for. He didn't know. Well, it was 9 years later that I'm kneeling in there saying, I wish I'd get a clue, and I began remembering those two guys. They 12-stepped me. Boy, underestimate that. They 12-stepped me, all right, but they never saw me. I never saw them after they got sober. And that's the kind of clues that I began to get. There was another one. There was a phone number on the back of a book of matches that this gal, in giving me the key, had also provided me with. And I discovered, and I reconfirmed it yesterday when I was having lunch with her, that their mother, her mother was an alcoholic, and there were a whole bunch of kids in that family that lived in San Mateo, and they had conspired amongst the kids and the father, I suppose, that they would have the AA phone number ready in case the mother ever said, "Okay, damn it, I'll call them." And they say, "Here it is." And they never did. She died in a nursing home only a year or so ago. Anyway, that's how that phone number happened to be on that book of matches, the two clues that I got. And I finally dialed the number. I began to run across attractive things. And because in that apartment during those 2 or 3 days, another thing I remember is that I had lost my sensitivity to the human condition. I had once experienced love, you know, love of teachers, love of classmates, love of parents, love of brothers and sisters, and just love. I had experienced that a lot in my life. I was sensitive, loving my patients. Man, I loved my patients. I knew what it felt to feel love, and I knew that I couldn't feel it anymore. I just could not. I had said, "Oh, screw it," once too many. Because "off screw it" kind of means for me, I am unwilling to consider any kind of intimacy. I know this is alienating what I'm doing, but Jesus, that's safer than intimacy. Because when I practice any kind of intimacy, I'm opening chinks, and people might take advantage of it and of the opening and start using me as a target. I guess I've been afraid of that. Anyhow, I've been afraid a lot too. I know that. Anyhow, I'd become impervious to the sights of beauty. I had once loved beautiful things. I had loved sunrise and sunsets and mountains and, you know, scenery. And I had loved these things. I had felt them. I had lost my sensitivity to the sounds of joy. I used to think about, I'd think about the expression, you know, children's laughter warm the cockles of your heart, the cockles of your heart. Jesus, let yours burn up. Don't let me listen to this goddamn giggling and laugh. Jesus, grates my nerves is what it does. Children's laughter. I had also lost the sensitivity to the cries and the sighs of sorrow. I couldn't stand patients complaining in my office. You know, that's a hell of a state, I'll tell you. Because if you're going to practice medicine, you're going to have to listen to some complaints. That's, you know, if you want to collect from Blue Cross, you got to listen to complaints. And man, I couldn't stand it, which is probably why I wasn't there. Well, I called AA. And I came in contact with something that I could not identify at the time. But I came in contact with spirituality right there during my first call. Because I know that the guy who answered the phone was committed to his own sobriety and he was concerned about mine. There's no question about that. I don't know what else took place during that conversation, frankly. But gave him a list of my degrees, too. I tell you, I wanted you people to know, you know, who was about to join. Who was considering joining, providing you would be deserving of it. Well, I don't know if you're deserving or not. I'll tell you one thing about you. You're goddamn attractive. And it doesn't surprise me to have a tradition that says, you know, our public relations rest. Well, my private relations with this fellowship also rest on attraction. I've never ceased to find it. What do I find attractive? I find everything attractive. The spirituality I found attractive from the beginning, even if I didn't know what it was. I found attractive an encounter I had or a meeting I attended once, and I've told the story many times, and I'll make it briefer. But I want to tell it because it's significant to me. Driving across the country, actually, going to Fort Benning, Georgia one time. In 1967, I was driving in a small Volkswagen. I was by myself. And going through New Mexico, I stopped because I was too tired. Or I was tired. And I knew that the next step was getting too tired. And I was hungry. And I knew that the next step was getting too hungry. So I stopped and got a motel room, which takes care of being too tired. Of not getting too tired, and I went to a restaurant next door which took care of not getting too hungry. And then I was still uncomfortable. I don't know why. And I thought, maybe I'm getting too lonely. Or maybe I'm lonely, and I could get too lonely. So what do I do now? I started roaming around asking for a meeting, if anybody knew about this outfit called AA. Not too many people knew. Finally, I was told there was a meeting on an Indian reservation 8, 10, or 12 miles out of town in the agency house. So I drove out there. There was an Indian sitting there. It was almost 8:30. I look at the time. I know it's past 9:30. You know, I know that. I look at the clock. I know that. I can see it well from here. Anyhow, I got this little sadistic streak and kind of enjoying this, really. Anyhow, I went in there, and the guy was sitting there by himself with the literature and asked me to sit down, told me his name, and told him mine. And we decided it was going to be a discussion meeting that night. So we had a meeting, and at 9:30, all those who cared to join him stood and said the Lord's Prayer. Anyhow, I started asking him, how many people do you usually have here? And he said, nobody. And that's the way Native Americans that I've known answer questions, like one word, nobody. And I'm not a Native American, and maybe that's why I said to him, what do you mean, nobody? Well, you know, if you look up the Webster or the Heritage Dictionary, I don't care what goddamn dictionary you look up, there is really no quarrels between the definitions of nobody. It only means one thing. And I kept saying, what do you mean, nobody? I should have known that about India. There were a lot of Native Americans where I live, or Native Canadians, whatever the hell. Anyway, Indian people. I drove up to a reservation one time up there near where I used to practice, and I said to one, another simple word. You know, I said to this guy standing by the road, I said, hey, Charlie, are you lost? He said, shit, no, I'm here. My goddamn tent is lost. What's the matter with this guy? You know, where did this guy get all this realism? Well, the guy in New Mexico said, nobody. Finally, I quit asking him this. I'm not getting anywhere. He's not explaining what he means by nobody. So fortunately, I said to him, fortunately for me, because I wanted to discover, why I was finding it so attractive, I guess. And anyway, I wasn't lonely anymore either. But I said to him, how long have you been doing this? And he said to me, 2 years. Boy, I started driving back to the motel and stopped by the road because I didn't think I could see the lane or couldn't see the edge of the road, frankly. Because I got choked up on this and said to myself, this guy has been sitting there for 104 Thursdays in a row with nobody coming for the one lousy night that I might be afraid or in danger of getting too lonely. He was attractive and he was committed and he was concerned about me. Boy, he was spiritual. No question in my mind. This has been happening all the time. This kind of spirituality has been happening to me all the time, all around me. I don't know if it happens in me, but it must. I hope it does. I sense it at times. The anonymity is attractive. The anonymity, I think, well, the 12th tradition, I'm not trying to rewrite them, says it's the spiritual foundation. What can that possibly mean? Is secrecy a spiritual foundation? Oh, there's secret societies. I've belonged to one or two that were not very spiritual, I'll tell you that. So secrecy is not necessarily a spiritual phenomenon. Discretion, okay, it gets close to spirituality. But I think the spiritual connotation of spirituality, of anonymity, is the fact that it puts us on an even keel. It's the fact that there's no competition here. And I know that I hated competition. I didn't know this till I started thinking about it or thinking of the attractions that I wanted to rediscover in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know now that I hated competition. I was an embarrassed winner. I bragged loudly about winning, but every time I bragged, I was embarrassed about it, so I didn't feel good about it. And I was a goddamn resentful loser, I'll tell you that. So competition is not for me, and one of the things that I found attractive when I came here is who's to compete? Compete with what? You're the worst drunk in town? Somebody's going to top you. Or you're the nicest drunk in town? Somebody's going to top that, too. You know, you peed in bed once a year? Somebody's going to tell you peed in bed every night. I don't know. No way that I can compete in here. Well, that feels good to me. And I'm going to reread, and I've done this many times. I'm going to do it again. Maybe I did it here when I came 3 years ago. I don't know that. I got brain damage also. I don't remember those things. That's my cop-out, one of them. And it says tonight, if I could find one fault with Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be, and I think those words are properly chosen, and I didn't choose them, but they happen to be properly chosen for me because it says if I could find one fault, I can't find any faults. I'm not looking for them. But if I could find one fault with Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be that we have not yet begun to tap the potential hidden in the last seven words of the 12th step. Practice these principles in all our affairs. It occurred to me not long ago that whenever I am sitting in an AA meeting, I am never aware that I am sitting next to another white man, another Catholic, another American or a Frenchman, Mexican, Jew, Muslim, or Hindu, black man, or brown. I am aware only that I am sitting next to another alcoholic. And it seemed deeply significant to me that this feeling of common humanity had been purchased by me at the cost of considerable pain and suffering. Should this hard-won understanding of and feeling for others be confined to the meeting halls and members of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or does it remain for me to take what I have learnt and what I have experienced, not only in AA, but in every other area and endeavor of my life, to lift up my head and to assume my rightful place in the family of man? Can I there, in the household of God, know that I'm not sitting next to another white man, another Catholic, another American, nor yet a Frenchman, Mexican, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, black man, or brown? And can I finally, at long last, please God, come home from all the wars and say in the very depths of my soul, I am sitting next to another human being?